Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Yeah, I didn't want to leave my country because we have a happy family, happy life. Now our family is separated.
I only ask all that. Please not war in our world. Please.
Tears are just coming, you know. I think I didn't feel anything then, and then I'm starting to realize. But I hope it's just a short time trip and we will be back soon.
I came here and I left my parents to die. And I told my husband, you've got to go back and bring them here because I can't just leave them to die.
2 million Ukrainian refugees in 12 days. Half of them, 1 million. Children. Another 1 million internally displaced in Ukraine, and all of those numbers will only grow. Well, Katerina Babkina is a Ukrainian poet, playwright, and author. She is now also a refugee in Wrocław, Poland. Katerina, hello.
Hey, Nana.
Hi. So you were living in Kyiv and had to flee with your daughter and mother on February 25th. Can you first tell us, Katerina, how did you make that decision to leave Ukraine?
It was a tough decision, Magna. It was a hard decision, obviously. I guess each of these 2 million people would say the same. Ukraine is my home. Whether I like something there or dislike, like everywhere there are some things you dislike, that was my home. That was my life. Also, as a writer, as a poet, I'm very connected to my mother tongue. I need it to sound around me. I need to speak the language. But when you hear the bombs exploding in your city, you kind of don't have much time to hesitate. I wasn't actually making the decision to leave. We left the house with my mom, my daughter, and my manager. We left the house for the night to visit a friend of mine to go to the bomb shelter of my friend, because so we grabbed just the most necessary stuff for the child. And then in the morning, on 25th, the bombing became so intense, we had to leave the city. So I was driven to the western part of the country, where they were not bombing yet. And we stand there overnight again at the house of my manager, at the house of her brother. And then, like, hear the sirens again, so I realized it's not a proper place for the child to be. So we redirected toward the Polish border. It's no time to make the decision, you know. When you escape, you do not decide much.
Mm.
So when I'm asked, like, how did they make the decision, I actually didn't. I was just, you know, escaping the sound of the bombs and the sound of the air alarm. That's it.
Yes. No, I understand. I understand. How old is your daughter?
She's 1 year old.
She's 1 year old. And how old is your mother, if I may ask?
She's 63. She's 63. She doesn't speak any foreign language properly. So it's very ruining experience for her to have to leave the home, because she was working as a teacher at school. She had her friends, she had her pupils, you know. She had all her life set, and she used to live in that part of Kyiv which suffered from the bombing at the very first day. So we don't even know if the building she was living at is still there.
What does she tell you about how what she feels about having to have left Ukraine?
She's very lost, very scared, because she had all her life set. On the other hand, she's very eager to help. She's very eager to volunteer. Now the Literature House in Wroclaw, who had accepted me and hosted me here, providing me the place to stay and also some fee, some like scholarship. They are setting up the place in their office where Ukrainian refugees can come with their children and, you know, like the free kindergarten or daycare or something like that. So my mother, Donna, also worked there with the kids because she's a teacher. And of course, all of us, we don't know what's going to happen to us in the future because, you know, you had, imagine, Magna, you had all your plans set for your nearest future. I don't know, the vacation plan, some career plan, some family plans. And then at one moment, everything is ruined. And you're abroad with no belongings, no money, no nothing. That feels a little bit frustrating. Though what really keeps us okay is the need to help other people. We are very focused now on possibility to help others.
Mm. I understand it took you 4 days to get to Wroclaw in Poland. Can you tell me a little bit about what that journey was like?
Normally, that would take me like 12 hours of driving, normally. But as we were stuck at the Polish border in the huge line of other people trying to escape Ukraine, both Ukrainians and foreigners, mostly people from the regions which were already hardly bombed by Russia, it was just like, you know, you're stuck in the time. You stay in the car all the time for the whole 3 days. Local people brought us some food, hot tea. Local people let me into their houses to, you know, to change the diaper and to wash my child with the warm water. Local people helped to those with who had something wrong with the cars because, I mean, people were driving whatever they had, not the well-prepared for such a journey car. And you just stay there and you're just trying to hold yourself together. At the same time, you're always online, checking the news, trying to help people who are trying to leave, like Kyiv or Kharkiv, or finding somebody who can provide medicines, finding somebody who can help people who have already crossed the border and don't know what to do. It really feels like you are stuck in the time, and it's night after night after night.
Katerina, it's the line is going up and down, but I heard you say that it was a very, very difficult journey, night after night after night. I also have to say, Katerina, in speaking with you and hearing the sound of your voice, you sound incredibly strong and incredibly steady right now.
Thank you, Magna.
How are you containing your heartbreak?
I guess I don't know yet. It's going to take time. I guess I still don't believe it. I mean, everybody was talking before it happened that it might happen. And we all were like, no, like, the some reasonable, cruel war in the central of Europe in 2022nd year. No way, this cannot happen. And now it's happening. They have killed like 40 children for this 2 weeks of war. And this is something which is so, so painful and so heartbreaking. I still cannot believe, I guess. I guess I need more time to understand what's going on and then to understand what do I feel.
Yes. No.
I'm hardly able, you know, even to cry. I'm just very focused on setting up my life first and then on any possibility I can help, I can be useful. So that's generally what now occupies me.
Yes.
I guess I'm going to understand what had happened to us all later.
Right. You know, I have to say your strength is so admirable because I'm struggling to find the right question to ask someone in your situation now who everything has been taken away from you. You're right. The only thing that matters is surviving from day to day. So let me just step back for a moment, Katerina, and ask you, Do you even give yourself a moment to think what might happen if you can never go back to Ukraine?
I don't think this is possible. Sooner or later, I'm sure we're gonna go back. We're gonna rebuild the cities, rebuild our streets, our homes. We're gonna stay happy and prosperous and free country. The thing is, what price we're gonna pay for this? How many lives it would cost? So that is why we are trying to address to all the governments and to all the countries to help us, to support us, not only with the sanctions towards Russia, but also with, like, sheltering our sky from bombing. And we should calm Russia down, otherwise it's dangerous, not only for Ukraine. I consider the whole world now in danger, but I believe it's gonna end.
Well, Katerina Babkina, Ukrainian poet, playwright and author who had to flee Kyiv with her one-year-old daughter and mother and now in Poland. Katerina, thank you so much. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about Europe's largest refugee crisis since the Second World War. 2 million Ukrainians and counting having had to flee Ukraine in the past 12 days. Another million displaced internally inside of Ukraine because of Russia's attack on the country. Now, 1.2 million of those Ukrainians have crossed into the border into Poland. Before the break, you heard Katerina Babkina, a Ukrainian who, after a four-day journey with her family, made it to Wrocław, Poland. So let's hear now from Natasha Bogacz. She joins us from Dorohusk on the border, crossing into Poland. She's a volunteer with Caritas Norway, helping refugees who are making it to Poland. Natasha, hello.
Hi, Meghna, how are you?
I think the question is more, how are you and how are all the people you are trying to help? So can you tell me a little bit about first about what you have been doing and what you have been seeing with the refugees coming to you?
Well, thank you. First of all, I'm actually not a volunteer. I'm employed by Caritas Norway, who sent me here. But I feel like, I mean, I'm doing all the work that the volunteers are doing, and I haven't had a free day in a week. So I guess this is a lot of the same kind of work. But I'm here mostly to, like, let Norwegian people also know what's happening in the Norwegian government, because we need their help here.
Mm.
So, and yeah, everyone is asking me how I am, and yeah, it's hard,
yeah,
but I'm fine.
Well, so as I said, 1.2 million and counting of those refugees have made it to Poland. It's a huge number for Poland to have to assist. Can you tell us a little bit about the conditions, what aid Poland is able to give, what the conditions the refugees are facing?
Yes. Yes, I mean, the numbers are unbelievable. It's kind of overwhelming, really. And also because it's like women and children and really small children. It's just, like I said, it's heartbreaking, overwhelming. And I mean, I'm really happy to be able to be here and help with Caritas on the border, because this is the first point where we can help together with volunteers. But I mean, I think that the numbers of volunteers in Caritas also must have like tripled the last few days, because everyone is coming to us and they want to help. And what we do is that we are on the border, and then we welcome the refugees and give them something warm to eat and to drink, because they're freezing. They've been waiting in line for many, many hours and sometimes days. And the weather here now is unusually bad. It's really cold. I've never been this cold in my life. I think it's the wind is blowing. The kids are getting... I mean, we had a kid here last night that was like, his body temperature was like 28 degrees Celsius, which is very, very low. Yeah. So they are very cold. They are very tired. But the really, most of them, they just want to get to the transportation point and just get to where they're going as fast as possible, because they've been already traveling for many, many hours and days.
So this cold, though, I just want to make a note of it, that there's an Arctic cold mass over Eastern Europe right now. And I'm seeing that the daytime high temperature for our U.S. listeners is in the 20 degrees Fahrenheit for the daytime highs. And it's supposed to stay cold like that for many, many days. Yeah. I mean, certainly that's a great danger to people to be exposed to that for hours and days.
Yeah, especially to kids, like small kids, they're getting cold really fast. And even not the temperature is not the worst, it's the wind that is the worst, because it's making it even colder.
Now, where are the refugees able to go after they have crossed the border, and groups like Caritas Norway first welcome them? Because I'm seeing reports of some have had to sleep for days in train stations in Warsaw, for example. Tell me more.
And this is what we've been seeing the last 2-3 days. Most of the refugees crossing, they have a friend or family in Poland, because you have to remember that since 2014, when the war in Ukraine started, we've had almost 2 million, like 1.5, I don't know the exact numbers, already refugees in Poland, people who just moved here and found work and have been living here ever since. And a lot of those crossing now are the family of those people that have been already living in Poland, and they are trying to get to them. Of course, the problem is transportation, because there's so many people. But I mean, the transportation is for free, all the trains and everything. So it just takes time, because you have to wait. And then it takes time to travel in Poland. It's a big country. And if you're going to Warsaw, it's going to take you another couple of hours from the border to get there, depending on where you're crossing. But the refugees are free to go wherever they want, and they are getting the information about the points where they can find shelter if they don't have a place to go. Because, like as I was saying, most of the people, they have an address. They know where they're going. They're going somewhere to friends and family, often abroad, like Berlin is popular, other countries. But more and more people have no idea what to do. Mm. The moment they cross the border, they just stand there. And it's like the most, I think it's difficult, especially with the older people, because I feel like the younger, like the mothers, even when they have like 3-4 children with them, they're going to get help, and they know they're resourceful, and they will kind of manage maybe. But the older people that never been abroad, I mean, most of those people has never traveled so far in their lives, and it's additionally difficult for them. And I've seen a woman in the bathroom now, on the, because I just came from the, right now I'm in the refugee center 2 kilometers away from the border, but I spent the day on the border, like taking people in, helping them carry their baggages across the crossing in case there was a family already waiting there for them. But I saw a woman, I think she might have been like 70 or 75, just sitting there. And she didn't have a place to go. And she just looked like so helpless. And like she was even registering what was happening. Like, I don't know what will happen with her, but I it's just like so sad. It's a tragedy to look and to look at it. And I don't know how I can help. But people are taking in, this is also, I think this is, I've been talking to many people. Have they ever seen anything like that? Like people with humanitarian organizations that've been in many wars before, but they never seen this kind of response when the refugees are being taken in by families, by people from all over the country. They're coming here to the border, they can register and they can offer accommodation. And even my high school friend right now, she's running a hotel and she just turned it around for a refugee shelter. She just texted me today. She has like almost 30 people, 40 wow. people. It's families, the whole families. And well, yeah, people are taking them in.
They're doing the best they can. I'm hearing you say
everyone. Yes. Yeah, it's amazing.
But Natasha, as you know, I'm seeing that Poland is taking in more than 100,000 new refugees every day.
Every day, yes.
Is it, if those numbers continue, which they almost certainly will? Yeah. I mean, will Poland have to start? I mean, what happens in other mass forced migration situations is that refugee camps have to be created. Is that, could that happen in Poland?
Yeah, I don't really know. I don't really follow the news, but it's, I try to stay away from the news actually. But we are getting at the max capacity, like all the schools, the gym halls, and the cultural center. Like right now, I'm sitting and this is a cultural center every day, and now it's filled with refugees. And all of the places are getting full. And also in Przemyśl, when I was the last couple of days, all the schools are, it's getting harder and harder to find a place for a mother with a child to sleep. And I don't know what's going to happen, but it's going to be really bad. It's already getting bad.
I think the only thing that that we can say with certainty that will happen is that it's going to get worse.
Natasha.
My last question for you. You mentioned at the beginning that Caritas Norway and other groups are also trying to get other governments to provide more assistance.
Yes.
What can you tell me more about that? Yes. What is needed?
I honestly, we need to also be able to send more help to Ukraine. It's very difficult. I think that Caritas is one of the few organizations who somehow, with the contacts they have in the church and in the Ukraine, they are managing to send like 10 trucks every day with the humanitarian aid, with food especially, and medicine. But I don't know how long we can continue to do that. And I just spoke to the foreign minister of Norway. This is why I'm here. She visited today and she spoke to many refugees and like was crying. And I think that she really understood the magnitude and the scale of the problem. And I hope that the Norwegian and also the EU government, they will support Poland in just like being able to send the resources that we need to provide for all these people. Mm-hmm. Because most of them, I mean, they don't want to go further away than Poland. This is also interesting. Like they have the possibility to go to other countries, but they want to stay here, preferably close to the border, because the hope for the war to end any day now is really big. every one of them, they want to go home as soon as possible. And in case the war might end this week, they want to be close to the border. Mm-hmm. So we just need to be able to provide for them here. And for that, we just need resources. Right.
Because every step away is one step further away from home for them. I completely understand. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's breaking their heart. Every step away is just another heartbreak.
Yeah. Well, Natasha Bogac with Caritas Norway, she's on the Ukraine-Poland border helping receive Ukrainian refugees. Natasha, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Mina.
Well, we've heard from On Point listeners who are reacting to the stories we're hearing and seeing of Ukraine's refugees. This is Ed, who called us from Atlanta with a message for a Ukrainian woman named Lesia, wherever she may be today.
I had a caregiver at a doctor's office years ago. Her name was Lesia. I mistook her for Russian. She corrected me. And this message is to her. I don't know, Lesia, if you have family there. I hope not. I presume that you might. And if so, just know that my heart goes out to them in the middle of all this. And I'm so sorry that this is happening.
Let's turn now to Sarah Deardorff-Miller. She's with us from Chicago. She's senior fellow at Refugees International, teaches courses on refugee protection at the University of London and at Georgetown as well. Sarah, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
How would you first describe the scale of the refugee crisis that Europe is facing right now?
Well, I think we've heard it quite clearly from your guests that you've had that it's been a scale and scope that we have not seen in a long time. I mean, globally, this is even a large outpouring since just the last couple of weeks. So that's pretty staggering if you just stop and think about the sheer numbers. And of course, going largely into Poland and other neighboring countries. Of course, you know, Europe and the region has more capacity to deal with it. But nonetheless, it has been on a scale and scope that we have not seen in a very long time, certainly in the region. And we're hearing, as your last guest mentioned, a lot of really good work that's going on along the border and very much still in emergency mode, right? Very kind of humanitarian crisis emergency response, which is great on face value, right? That's important in these early days. I think what will be key is thinking about the longer term and sustainability. But just kind of giving credit where it's due, it is heartening to hear this groundswell of support from people around the world. And part of me, because I work in this space, wishes I could bottle that up and keep that for other parts of the world where we see large outpourings of refugees that do not get as much attention or are not viewed with as much compassion and concern.
Indeed.
But certainly on this scale, it is a massive, massive outflow
of
refugees.
I really take your point, the one you just made, Sarah. And so just let me ask you, we've got about 2 minutes before we have to take our next break. Two things you said. Yeah, Europe has capacity. Right. I mean, we're talking about a lot of rich countries that either are receiving refugees or can provide a material assistance. So how does what we've been seeing compare to, you know, other refugee situations that you've worked in?
It's an important question. And that's not to underscore how challenging it is in these receiving countries and for the rest of the EU to really take big and bold steps. You know, implementing this new EU Temporary Protection Directive will be really important as a way to provide safety and support. But certainly compared to other regions, there's still great need and things are very dire. We work a lot on northern Ethiopia, for example, where there remains large widespread famine, man-made famine due to the conflict. We see large refugee situations in other regions as well that do not have the resources and capacity to deal with the infrastructure and some of the coordination mechanisms that we see. So we also hold Europe accountable to coordinate a response that is fitting. And there certainly is the public support and goodwill right now. So I think capitalizing on that in this moment is really important and following through on some of the promises that have been made.
Well, we'll talk more about that after we come back from a quick break. This hour, we are taking a look at Europe's largest refugee crisis since the Second World War. When we come back, we'll hear more from Sarah Dierdorf-Miller, who's with Refugees International, and we'll also hear from a Ukrainian who's been displaced internally in the country. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And a little editorial note, earlier this morning I was talking with my staff about what I called humanity's unending capacity to exact cruelty on each other, but we cannot and must not turn away, and so we won't, not just in Ukraine, but elsewhere. So here's a little heads up about what we're talking about tomorrow. We're going to be talking about burn pits tomorrow, and those were those vast pits that the United States military dug in Iraq and Afghanistan and threw all its military waste into and set alight with jet fuel. Well, the smoke from those burn pits has made many soldiers and many civilians sick, and so we're going to be talking about the impact of that and whether or not the United States government is finally ready to acknowledge the long-term health implications of burn pits in places where it has exacted war. So if you are a victim of burn pits or you know a veteran or soldier or civilian that has suffered from them, please do give us a call with your story. We're at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today, we're talking about Ukraine's refugee crisis, Europe's refugee crisis, in fact. 2 million Ukrainians in 12 days being forced out of the country, another million displaced internally. I'm joined today by Sarah Dierdorf-Miller. She's a senior fellow at Refugees International. And Sarah, I just want to play something. We received this call from Jean, who listens to On Point from Los Angeles.
Could you please make some small mention about the non-Ukrainians who are not being allowed to leave? We hear of Romani and African students and others who are being turned away at borders and not allowed to board buses and trains. It just seems a shame.
Sarah, you want to respond to that, please?
Yeah, I agree that it has been worrisome. There have been a number of reports, and we've had a team there led by actually the president of our organization, Eric Schwartz, who have also raised concerns about this, that non-Ukrainian nationals are not being treated fairly, having difficulty getting out and crossing. And so I agree that it has been a really worrisome point. And, you know, among international humanitarian law, one of the most fundamental priorities is letting people run for their lives, letting people flee. And so as much as Russia has not had a good track record on this, it has to continue to be a priority. Everyone, not just Ukrainians, but all different groups who have been trying to get out and flee to safety. So that is definitely something that we're watching closely and we care deeply about. Of course, officials have said that it has not been happening or on a lesser scale. But given the reporting and that which our team has also been concerned about, we're emphasizing that non-discrimination must take place in people running for their lives.
How is it supposed? I mean, how does that work at the border when people finally arrive at whichever border, Poland, et cetera, when they're trying to flee? I mean, is it up to an individual border guard to make the decision? I mean, is there a way to really stem the kind of discrimination that we've been seeing?
I mean, I think unfortunately it will come down to individual border guards, but of course we would hope that the policies would be echoed from on high all the way down so that we would see less of this. Certainly now that it's making a lot more news, there's been widespread reporting on this, and hopefully some of the embassies of the nationalities involved will take a more active role in helping get people out. We've certainly seen pleas to individual governments to get people out. But it's definitely something that I think we need to continue to watch. And I think, especially as we're calling for, you know, humanitarian corridors, letting people get out, that needs to apply universally to everyone. And I should also mention that people internally displaced, while we're focusing a lot on refugees, of course, who've crossed a border and gotten to another country, those who are still displaced internally also need protection and access to medicine and food. And in many cases, in most refugee cases, internally displaced persons, IDPs as we call them, are the hardest to reach. And sometimes it's an even more difficult humanitarian operation. So the IDPs in this situation also need a lot of attention as well.
Well, in fact, let's turn now to someone who has been internally displaced from his home in Hostomel in Ukraine. Oleksandr Mikhed joins us. He's a writer, a literary scholar, and art curator, and a member of PEN Ukraine as well. And as I mentioned, he had to flee his home and it yet is still in Ukraine, an internally displaced person. Oleksandr, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah.
Nice to hear you.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about what has happened to you and when you had to leave your home?
Everything started just from the first day. We got a call around like 6 a.m. and our friend from Borispol, which is our biggest airport in Kyiv, and she called us, me and my wife, and she said like everything got started. And we immediately understood what's actually happening because we were prepared for that. That was on Thursday. And for example, on Monday, we got a supper with my parents who lives like in 10 minutes by car from us in another small town called Bucha, which is now also well-renowned all over the world because there is the airport. And on Monday, for example, we've talked about the war. And my dad, who is professor of literature, he is one of the biggest specialists on Mykola Gogol or Nikolai Gogol, famous writer in Ukraine. Mm. Yeah. So we've talked about the possibility of war. And my dad said, oh, nothing going to happen. Something going to happen. It might happen only in Donbas, in eastern part of Ukraine. And that's it. Putin will never make it big. Me and my wife, we've asked my parents to be prepared at any moment to flee away and to be prepared with the car, with the fuel, with the bags, and be just please, guys, be prepared. That was on Monday. Everything started on Thursday at 6:30 a.m. We got woke up and then just helicopters, Russian occupants and helicopters arrived around like 8 a.m. on Hostomel and in Bucha. And they started bombing the Bucha airport. And my parents, their apartment is in the, how you call it, in the apartment building on somewhere at the 7th floor. So my mom, she saw this bombing of the Bucha airport, the Hostomel airport. And she told me just, we were talking on the phone and she said to me like 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 7, 10, 13 helicopters were bombing Hostomel airport and my mom was watching it. So that was the beginning of the day. We were prepared. We got two bags and still we haven't had the possibility to get away because everybody tried to get away. And we live near the huge highway. It's so-called Warsaw Highway. It's just in front of our townhouse in Hostomel.
Yes.
So everybody tried to get out from Kyiv, from Bucha. And that was happening until 4 p.m. And then at 4 p.m., my neighbor, who is also, he is the cultural activist. He is a translator from Italian, and he is just brilliant linguist. So that's like those for just I'm trying to name all these specifications about who we are for American listeners to understand that those internally displaced people, those are real people with real stories. And that's what's happening with us.
Yeah.
And those are not abstract numbers. So he, at 4 p.m., he told me, like, we want to get away. He, his wife, and their child, and another our neighbor. And my wife at that moment, she went to the zoo shop. She tried to buy some snacks for our dog. And she thought that was the last chance to get the special food dog before something even greater might happen. So she took the car of our other neighbor and she went to the zoo shop. Can you believe that? Just in front of the bombing with these helicopters, rocket launchers and everything. Because my wife and me, we really love our dog. Mm-hmm. So she went there. And just in front of her, there was, I don't know how to call it properly in English, when the helicopter, it brings with the rockets that try to trick the launchers that are supposed to fight the helicopter. So those are like fake rockets after it. So my wife, she just saw these fake rockets in front of her, in front of her face. And when she arrived from the zoo shop with the food for our dog, I've told her, I've seen how she was horrified with these fake rockets.
Alexander? We'll try to get Alexander back there. He was describing how he and his wife had to flee their home in Hostomel in Ukraine. It's interesting. Alexander had also mentioned that his father is one of the experts in Gogol, the famed Ukrainian writer. It just reminded me that Nikolai Gogol's most famous story of the overcoat, about a man who loses his overcoat and a government clerk. His cloak gets stolen and no one is willing to help him find that prized possession, even after it worries him, even after his death. And Gogol, in that story, he writes, in accordance with the primitive arrangement of things, the most trifling causes produce the greatest events. Now, Sarah Deardorff-Miller with Refugees International, we only have 5 minutes left, and I do apologize. But you talked a little bit earlier about the long-term concerns you have, the sustainability of the relief efforts that have been going into the past 12 days to help Ukrainian refugees and try to get help to internally displaced people. I had asked Natasha with Caritas Norway a little bit earlier if places like Poland may have to set up refugee camps. I mean, tell us a little bit more about what your long-term concerns are.
Yeah, I think that's the real issue that we're trying to spend a lot of time thinking about. Of course, the urgent emergency humanitarian assistance is critical at this stage, right? People need food, water, shelter, sanitation. There's COVID concerns. There's gender-based violence concerns, right? There's large numbers of women and children that have arrived. I was struck by one of your guests, who's the Caritas worker, who said that most people coming have an address. And that's heartening for these kind of earlier groups, if you will. People have somewhere to go. What concerns me is that as the time goes by and the conflict continues, the groups who tend to come in later flows don't have the connections, don't have the resources or the safety nets. They may be in a more dire or desperate situation. And of course, sustainability for Poland and other hosting countries is the main concern. People are going to be having long-term effects, suffering long-term effects of this. Psychosocial support will be needed. Job training, livelihoods. Many refugees, maybe their profession that they worked in at home, won't be accessible to them. They'll need credentialing. They'll need new training. They'll need language training. The effects of this will be very long. And of course, the separation of families, many of these situations are traumatic for individuals, for children, for others. And keep in mind, for all of us, just coming out of the pandemic, right? Just starting to have kids back in school and regular work-life routines. So the long-term concerns are going to be critical for those displaced themselves. And one thing that I would emphasize is that we need to listen closely to the displaced, because those of us who work in this space tend to kind of go to our usual solutions and coordination, et cetera. But the people who are best placed to talk about what is important, for what type of solution fits for them, whether they hope to return home as soon as they can, whether they want to be somewhere else, are the displaced themselves. So we really need to listen carefully, as you are doing with these guests, to what their situation and their needs are. Yeah. But definitely the longer-term planning, development actors, financing institutions like the World Bank, all of these organizations and groups and bodies that can think longer-term, think about support for self-reliance and sustainability, job access, all of these things are going to be critical in the months and years to come. Because even if the fighting stops tomorrow, people are still going to have a long, long recovery from this.
Well, so Sarah, just one last brief question for you, because I think we have Alexander back and I want to give him the last word. But quickly, when people hear conversations like this, they always write and say, how can we help? So what would you say, tell folks?
Absolutely. I mean, it's great to hear that there is this groundswell. Of course, there are any number of organizations that are doing good work. Lots of humanitarian groups are responding in country. We're also proposing that the U.S. Offer to resettle a number of Ukrainian refugees, and individuals around the U.S. can support resettlement agencies that are resettling refugees from other parts of the world who are also in dire straits. So they can either provide funding, or, you know, they can donate money, or they can donate their time, their resources. Lots of resettlement groups are working hard to help refugees who are already coming to the U.S. and have also been displaced for many years. So it's great to hear that there is such such a groundswell of support, and we hope we can sustain that because this is really what, you know, the global refugee regime is predicated upon, this this understanding that people are running for their lives, and we have a duty to support
and protect them. Well, Sarah Deardorff-Miller with Refugees International, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, I think we have Alexander in Ukraine back. Alexander, we have 1 minute left, and I'm so sorry that we lost your line a little bit earlier. But in that 1 minute, can you tell me what you want, you most want listeners to know right now?
I want everybody to understand that this is not a Ukrainian-Russian war. This is the war of the world against Russia, and everybody can help. Everybody could be useful in fighting against this totalitarianism, against this horror of this imperia, because this country won't stop. It always wants to feed by chaos, and it wants to horror you. So please, guys, join this war and please help us to win, as we believe that we will win, and all people that are temporarily left our country, they will come back.
Well, Alexander Mihed is a writer, a literary scholar, and an art curator, a member of PEN Ukraine. He and his family had to flee their home in Hostomel in Ukraine, and he is now internally displaced in his country. Alexander, thank you. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. for and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall, because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.